Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
G'day everybody, it's Aaron Noonan here. Great to have you with us. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. Before we get stuck into this episode, a quick mention. Every Tuesday, the Castrol Motorsport News Podcast with Andrew Van Lord and Stefan Bartholomaeus. It's the latest for your news and views on Australian and world motorsport. And I'm back every Thursday with Repco Supercars Weekly as well. But this podcast is the first of a two-parter with the man who was our very first guest back in May 2019 when we started the podcast, John Bow. Now, back then, we sat in different chairs, actually. We just swapped chairs this time, but it's plenty new in terms of the chat. Lots of great stories, lots of great content. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. In part one, he tells stories about a bunch of stuff, including growing up in Tasmania, his days at school, spending a lot of time outside the deputy headmaster's office, it should be mentioned, and also watching racing at the famous Longford Road Circuit as well. We talk about how he got into racing himself and why he went with open wheelers instead of touring cars. We also talk about why he remembers where he was the day that Elvis Presley died. 1977, he remembers where he was because of racing. You'll hear the story in this pod. Of course, we talk about the Swedish block of flats, the Volvo 240 Turbo Group A car, and the mighty Viscanda sports car. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part one. John Bow on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco. Well, he is the guest that kicked us off on episode one of the V8 Sleuth podcast. It is still the most downloaded episode in the history of the V8 Sleuth podcast. And I thought for EP 189, I'd get the 1989, see what I did there, yeah. Bathurst 1000 winner John Bow back in the studio. Welcome back, JB.
Thank you, Aaron. It's amazing, isn't it? Honestly, seems like yesterday that we sat here and did the same thing, except I was on the other side and you were this side.
So we've swapped the chairs.
So we've swapped the chairs around.
We've had a global pandemic. We've had a lot of drama.
Since we
started this back in 2019. But yeah. The good thing is we didn't even come close to touching on everything, because we covered and jumped around a bunch of different topics.
Yep.
So I thought we've got some questions that
you're very
have come
well
in
prepared
from our,
there, I oh, can
yeah,
see.
I've got some notes. Don't I worry. Yeah,
you're
prepared.
Not like me. You don't just wing it.
I've winged a few things in my time, but the great skill, JB, is making it look like you're not winging it when you're
That's
winging
true.
It.
That's true.
So one thing we didn't talk about last time, when you're a young bloke in Tassie, so you grew up in Devonport.
Yes.
Common thread I find when I talk to racing drivers, whether they're currently the young crop of supercars coming through, the veteran guys, whenever I talk to them about when they were a kid, it's kind of that school report of could do better, should listen more, should try harder. Were you one of those as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Right.
Absolutely.
So you're the next one on the list. Okay.
I can still, you know, picture my poor mum, who's since left us, doing the washing up, saying, I got your report today and I'm, you know, really disappointed in you because you didn't do what I think you can do. You know, I mean, I was always in trouble, always
not fulfilling potential.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I wasn't I was naughty slightly, I guess, which I've probably continued through most of my life, although I'm certainly cured now. But I was, just a rascal, and spent a lot of my time outside the deputy headmaster's office at Devonport High, and prior to that at Nixon Street Primary, which my kids went to.
What was the main offence? What were you always in trouble for?
Being naughty.
Just generally
just being
kid
naughty,
stuff.
Just kid stuff, being naughty. Nothing really terribly bad, but just at the time, you know, discipline was very strong, and I learned how to get the cane. without it hurting too much. You know, so you'd put one finger up a bit higher, so you only got it on one finger. So you had one sore finger, but the rest
rather
of the
hand than a whole hand.
Yeah, exactly.
Smart.
Yeah,
smart.
So, I look back on that and think it was a disappointment to myself, really, in some ways. But I also believe, without being too mystic meg about it, that, you know, you're meant to do something, and if you actually get to fulfil that something, whatever it is, whether it be racing or journalism or whatever, if you get to do it and you actually really enjoy it, you're very lucky. So I look back and I think I'm, you know, lucky.
Yeah. Had the car bug bitten when you're in that school phase? Or
absolutely.
Was that one of the distractions of,
I just don't
need to be at school here, I'd rather go and tinker with cars and look at cars?
I didn't ever think I shouldn't be at school because you just went to school, but I my dad was a mechanic, a motor mechanic, and he always had race cars of some description, which back in those days, you know, might have been an MGTF with bigger carburetors and a ported head or something. You know, it wasn't, they weren't exotics. But so we always had a car in our garage, and it was just a little suburban house. I took my partner, that's what they call girlfriends now, don't they? Partners?
Do. Yeah, okay.
I took her to Tassie recently to see my dad, who just turned 90.
Oh, well played.
And I took her around all the places that I used to go, you know. So I took her past my first girlfriend, Cheryl's house. And
was Cheryl still there?
No, I don't know. I didn't stop. I didn't stop.
That's an obvious question.
I didn't knock on the door. I took her up to the bluff where my mates and I used to do handbrake spins on the grass to see how close to the cliff edge we could get without going off. And I took her past my original house, which was, you know, where my dad had race cars. Mm. So he did other people's race cars, helped prep them, I guess you'd call it. And later he had his own. So I grew up with that all around me. We used to go to all the race meetings. We went to the very first Simmons Plains.
When was that?
60, I think.
Yeah, when it opened.
Yeah. We went to all the Longfords. I still remember, you know, being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by the old man so that we could get into the track before they closed the roads.
So,
I've got a lot of memories, yeah.
You said about naughty kid before. Is there some story about pinching cordial bottles? What's the story? What's the story there?
Well, no. There is two stories, actually. We used to go to, say, let's call it Simmons Plains, but we used to do it at Longford. We'd go to Baskerville too. My brothers and I would collect cordial bottles and cash them in at the
empties.
At the shop. Yeah. So, I think you used to get sixpence each for them or something. And that was what we went for. We didn't actually go to watch the races or anything like that. We went to get some money. So, you know, I was entrepreneurial in a very small way and still are in a very small way. So, but I did get into trouble once I had a paper round, and the guy who had the news agency that I used to go and do the paper round for was a guy called Frank Kirison. And his establishment was about a kilometre away from the factory where they had Coca-Cola and tea up. So it was not far up the road. And part of my paper round was going past there on the way back to the shop to, you know, whatever. And one day we were riding past another guy and I on our push bikes, finished the round, and we noticed that the garage door was open. And they had this truck, cordial truck, and it had like crates of cordial on it. So we knocked off a few
permanently borrowed bottles
of Fanta, because Fanta was new then. It was pretty good, you know. We thought, wow, this is good. So we probably, I don't know how many we took, but we got caught, basic bottom line is, and I got into a shitload of trouble. I don't know whether you're allowed to say shit on podcast.
It's okay. Yeah. You can pretty much do it.
So that was my life of crime. It came to an end very quickly. Luckily, probably, I might have ended up doing something else. I don't know.
Cordial bottles lead to Coke bottles, lead to Fanta bottles. Yeah. Who knows?
Lead to whatever. I might have robbed a bank, but
I
didn't.
Could have been a beverage entrepreneur.
It could have been. Should have been.
What was your first car? What was the first thing, or the first thing you drove maybe before you had your first actual road car?
I drove lots of cars because my dad encouraged us boys to drive. So we used to go for a, say, like our families did then, Sunday drive, and he would let us all drive. So we'd sit, you know, when I was little, I'd sit on his knee and drive and do the gears and do the steering, and he'd do the clutch, and then later as I got taller, I'd do the whole thing. And I remember my younger brother, Robin, who we used to play tricks on him. You know, we'd go, oh, look at that cow over there, and he'd look at the cow when he was steering. He was only little, and he'd turn the steering wheel as he looked. So he'd just about, old man, I'd have to grab the steering. You know, like it's crazy family memories. But, yeah, so I drove from a very young age, probably 5 or 6 years old. And later on I used to drive my mum's – she had a two-tone FJ. So it was right at the end of the FJs.
Yep.
And it had two-tone seats. It was very – trick
this,
thing
this is
at
like
the time.
Tasmanian trick. You know?
Yeah,
this
no, it was very, you know, it's like having a Lamborghini now or something like that with a black roof. You know, it was two-tone blue. It was 1955. I think they changed in 55 or 56 or something. Anyway, she had one of those. And I used to drive it up and down the drive. And it's a normal suburban block, not a rambling castle driveway or something, you know, and I'd get it from first into top gear by the time I got to the top of the driveway. So I had the addiction quite early, although I had no intent to be a racing driver, so to speak.
First actual road car? Or did you get your license in maybe?
I got my license in an EK Holden that my dad had.
But did you fail first time?
No.
Oh, like Neil Crompton did.
No. I did it easy. I'd been driving since I was five.
Yeah.
But it was Tassie too, you know, like probably the standard was
looser.
It was probably Lucy. You just had to – they made you drive around the block and you had to do a hill start. That was it. So I knew how to do a hill start because I'd been taught how to do a hill start. So my first car I had, I think, have we touched on this before, a Volkswagen. I had a Volkswagen Beetle.
Yes.
So that was without my parents' knowledge. So that's a long and involved story. But the first car that I had that was known to my parents was I bought this EK Holden off my dad, and it was a nice original car. And he made me, made me pay it off, and I can't remember how much money it was. And then I lowered it and I put twin carbies on it. And extractors and all that sort of stuff that people did then.
It's funny, so many people now see you race the Tirana in the Touring Car Masters, but knew you for racing Fords for so many years in V8s and Sierras and stuff like that. So a lot of the fans feel you're a Ford man.
They do, yeah.
But they just can't get their head around the whole
– they still can't.
You race a Tirana, but you had a Holden history
Absolutely, and they still can't. I mean, I have comments quite often about, you know, you're in the wrong car or whatever. But, you know, I mean, my dad was after he stopped being a mechanic, was a salesman at the Holden dealership in Tassie then, and for many years was called Motors Proprietary Limited, and it was owned by the Nettlefold family, and they had branches in every reasonably sized town or city. So the head office was Hobart, and they had Launceston, Devonport, Ulverston, Burnie. And he went and was a salesman there. When Holden owned the world, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they owned the world. Their market share was huge. So, you know, he worked there as a salesman for many years. So, you know, us kids as little –
just around cars.
Little kids, And if they had a new model come out, you know, they'd newspaper the showroom and it had room for two cars in there. And, you know, you'd go down and have a sneak look at this brand new model. It was very exciting as a kid because there wasn't much going on then. You know, there wasn't no social media, very basic television,
video games,
nothing. So there wasn't much to do. Like you went outside as a kid, and you know that your parents would send you outside in the morning and you'd come back at night, you know. I mean, no one worried about getting abducted or
kick the footy, ride your bikes,
play marbles, whatever, you know. You'd be all over the place. So it was different.
Every lap in under a minute, every move made to matter, every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.
Now, in prep for this interview,
yeah,
I read it. Well, actually, Will Dale here informed me in a magazine that he found in 1977. So this stuns me that you retired. You've done a lot of racing since then.
For a retired bloke.
I think it was just code for didn't have enough money at the time for the next car. But clearly you got over that hump because we're here and there's about 40-odd years of history after that. But so racing for you, was it Formula V, Formula Ford? Like, were you always going to be an open wheeler guy at the time, or was it what was available?
No, that was my dad. You know, we were open wheeler people. He had sports cars when he was young, when I was a little kid. He had an MG TC, sort of a special with a supercharger and a fiberglass body. That's the first car he had, first racing car. And then he had a Lotus 11 replica that a guy built in Launceston and so on and so on. So eventually he ended up with an Elfin, which started his relationship with Elfin, which started my relationship with Elfin. So, we just, you know, when I started racing, my dad and I went to race meetings regularly and we talked to various people and, you know, about what I was going to race. Because after the Volkswagen story, which people have to listen to again on the earlier podcast. After that, he said, you know, this is lunacy or something to that effect. Well, I think we should get you a racing car. I'll go your halves in it. So we went and talked to various people and we looked at various cars like you do. And a guy called Pat Stride was the father of Formula V in Tassie. And his son does commentary still at Simmons Plains in Baskerville. He's still involved in it. And his dad was the father of Formula V. So he started Formula V in Tassie. So he talked us into a Formula V.
It's his fault. Well,
it is his fault, yeah. And so we bought a Formula V. And then open wheelers were, you know, what we did. I was never interested in touring cars or anything. When they were on at the track, you know, we went and got a hot dog or something. Yeah, so I was never interested. The only reason I became interested was way later when I won the Gold Star, like the Australian Drivers Championship, and the guy that sponsored me was a bloke called Chris Leach, and he had a company called Lucky Nuts,
which people still snigger about to this day.
They do, and they used to make fun of it, but it was a product for cooking, walnuts and almonds and stuff like that. And he was a terrific bloke at the time. I mean, I couldn't have gone on without him. But he was going to, you know, he figured that he'd done what he wanted to do, as in terms of sponsorship and whatever and achievement. And so I was about to retire again. So I thought, you know, the only way to go forward, that's forward as in F-O-R-W-A-R-D.
Forward.
Not forward the car, was to try and drive a touring car. So then I chased quite hard to get a touring car drive. So. That's how it happened. Nowadays it's different. It is really different. I don't like saying that because it makes you sound old, but
it's true though.
It's different. It's very, very different. Like how I got to be a touring car driver was that I just brown-nosed my way around everybody until someone gave me a drive.
Doesn't make any difference from many others.
I didn't have any money and then no sponsorship to add to it, but that's how it happened, you know, and that's how it happened forever and a day, really.
Yeah, we'll drive. Mm. Can drive. Have no money, but can drive, which is kind of a bit that you that
I didn't
you
even say that, but I guess my time in single-seaters had shown people, because people were more discerning than you reckon when you're that age, when you're younger. Mm. They notice more than you, and obviously I could drive to some degree. So I got a drive, and it was with Volvo. And in 1986, and it's funny because I went down to the historic Phillip Island, and I was going to race, but my friend Joe, whose car I was going to race, was sick, so we decided not to do it. So I spent quite a lot of time with John Shepherd, and Sheppo basically gave me my first drive in a touring car. You know, I mean, Mark Petch gave me the first opportunity, which was in 85 at Bathurst, but to join the series was you know, Sheppo's doing. So
you went V's, Formula Fords, Formula 3,
Formula 2, Formula 5000.
Yeah. Formula Pacific.
Yes.
You know, Atlantic, Montreal, whatever, 80s, whatever it was called. A couple of Australian Drivers' Championships along the way there, through there. So probably before we get to Volvo, though, F5000, all those things I like to drive, those elephants.
Well, I gave – I actually did the Formula 2 and the 5000 at the same time.
It'd be like these days kind of doing S5000 and – Formula Ford or Formula 3 or something like that at the same time.
Yeah, it would be. Jumping between the two. I didn't think anything of it. It was just an opportunity. But it was the relationship with Gary Cooper, that who was Elfin, that brought it on. And he, you know, he took a shine to me. And without him, I would have been retired in 1977.
What was the thing that – I'd like to ask people this. Along the way, there's people who make the difference that help you get to the next tier and that stuff. What did he see in you? What do you think he thought that he was getting?
I think he thought he liked us. He was a very shy, retiring kind of guy. You know, he wasn't a noisy character. And he'd seen me race. You know, we had a great flock of Elfins. You know, all those cars that we just mentioned before were all Elfins. So we used to, you know, I used to call him almost daily, you know, just to chew the fat.
Yeah,
just to yarn about stuff. And he'd seen me drive Elfins, and I had a Formula 3 Elfin 700 with a little Ford engine. I think this is what sparked it, or maybe wrong, because he passed away a long time ago when he was very young. But I had an Elfin 700, which wasn't fashionable. I think it was only about three of them made, and a Ford engine, which wasn't fashionable. And Brian Sampson, who fortunately is still with us, Peter Macro is still with us, and Brian Sheedy, who isn't, were the kings of Formula 3. And they came over to Baskerville, and I was clearly faster than them, clearly.
So you had reference points then
that
people would go, if you could beat them.
Yeah, so I think that's what – I mean, Gary was always interested in us because I guess we bought stuff off him, you know, parts and bits and pieces. We'd never bought a new car until a bit later. And then that produced the interest. And he took me over to Adelaide. They were sponsored by Ansett Team Elfin. Was a big deal. He took me over. It was like getting invited to you lived in UK, it'd be like getting invited to test for Tyrrell or someone, So he took me to Adelaide. Dad came with me, and I had a test drive in the 5000. So, you know, I remember clearly it was when Elvis died.
77?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clearly, yes. It was the day.
Oh, the day of?
The day of.
So where were you when the – because slightly before my time, but yeah, people will remember.
Well, time,
they remember, well, they remember where JFK was killed.
Yes.
When Elvis died.
John Lennon got shot,
So were you at the track?
I was at the track, AIR.
And in those days, it's not like you just checked Twitter to find this stuff
out.
No,
you didn't know. It was on the news.
Yeah.
On the radio. Gary had a Datsun 240K. Which were quite a good car, and we were driving out to the track in this.
For your big test, and you're
from
all
a big test, yeah. And I mean, I was nervous as a buggery, and I had a pain in the stomach, and you know, I was in a real state, you know, because my dad always, hosed me down, like it was always, you know, don't do anything stupid, There's no his favourite saying was, "There's no sheep stations at stake here," you know, like just enjoy yourself, do your best, whatever, but don't do anything stupid. Now, I have done the odd stupid thing in a car for sure, which I'm sure people will know about. But, you know, I was always quite moderated, tried to be anyway. And, yeah, anyway, so I drove the 5,000. I drove it reasonably well. It wasn't any, like, lap time stuff or anything. And then later on he gave me an opportunity. It wasn't that year, though. It was 78 or 79 when I actually raced it. Mm. I can't remember. But, yeah, and we had a – he told me or told us that we should sell the 700 and he'd build a new car for us. And if we paid for the car – he'd make the engine. It was when the single camshaft Formula 2 was about to start. So it was going to be a 782, but in true Gary fashion, it was a 792 because right. it took a year longer than it was supposed to take, but that was normal.
So we had to rewind there, but let's go back to Volvo land. So as you said, you drive with Robbie Francovic in the Enduros for Mark Petch in 85. Mm-hmm. The Volvo dealer team comes on board the next year with the white cars with Robbie, and then you're on board, Petch is out, Sheppo's in. I think you debuted at Adelaide. So we're talking Adelaide International Raceway here for those who are perhaps a bit younger who just think of the street track.
Yeah.
This is the AIR that Bob Jay owned for years. It had a big, long, huge straight.
Absolutely.
If you went off on it, you were still going.
Yep.
Still going.
Yeah, I went off in the Viscander.
You're ruining all my segues.
Sorry. Segway. I love that word. I did the debut was at AIR, and it was probably the third round of
it was a couple or of
fourth
rounds.
Round,
I think it was fourth round.
Yeah, of the championship. So and I was on the front row. So, I suppose in today's terms, if you turned up at the supercar meeting and you hadn't
straight out
raced before in a touring car sort of thing, and you're on the front row, you'd get huge acclaim, I guess, wouldn't you? But not then really,
because it was. I think you finished fourth in Adelaide and then you're on the front row in Perth and
led. I was on pole.
And you led.
Yeah. Adelaide, I outbrake myself in the first turn, so I ran out of talent very early. And in Perth, which is the week later, I was on pole. So, and Brocky led the race off the start. We never did anything like practice starts or anything. So
just
you're just in and like whatever you do, rev it up and drop the clutch. And, so I passed him in the end and comfortably led. And then the car broke down. I can't remember. I think something happened to the ignition or something. Mm. Anyway,
What was Francovic like? Because he only appeared here for a brief period. It's a bit prior to my time. But he won the championship that year. So we can tell what happened there and how, and then it all turned to crap later in the year. But what was he like? Because I get the impression he was a difficult dude.
Well, he was I always got on fine with him, but he was difficult. Yeah. People found him difficult. Certainly.
Just hard to relate to or intense
just very intense and quite temperamental. This is my view. I'm watching from the outside seeing this stuff. I was clearly the number two driver. Very, you know, he was incredibly temperamental. So if things weren't going his way, he was very – he'd spit the dummy very easily. And Mark Petch was friends with him and probably still is and knew how to handle him. And they would argue flat out, like incredible arguments, like shouting arguments. And Robbie would storm out the back and come back 10 minutes later and get in the car and go really well.
So you reckon it was a thing he needed to get himself
up and going, up and fired? I think so, yeah. Me being an amateur psychologist 30 years later. When Sheppo came along, he was very ordered, very orderly and ran everything with an iron fist and you know, his record speaks for itself. You know, he was a very good team manager, team boss, and he wouldn't allow any of this stuff to happen. So Robbie lost his mojo. Mm. So as I said, being an amateur psychologist, I think like Robbie won the championship through consistency. He had those early races where he won some races and then later on he tapered off and he was not competitive, very competitive anyway. And that's how the whole demise of the team came about. But
before the team demised,
yeah,
you actually, because am I right in remembering that at Lakeside you gave up your car for him to drive?
Yeah.
Because he's had a problem. So had you not done that, he doesn't win the championship.
No, I suppose not.
So you did your bit to help out there.
Yeah, well, I probably have never thought of it like that, to be honest. But, yeah, the second car was a right-hand drive car that the factory had in Sweden as a test car. So it was the only right-hand drive car ever made, except the one Sheppo built later. Mm. So I think it was when Mark Petch was still involved, him and Sheppo went to Monza, saw all the factory people. They were racing in the European Touring Car Championship, managed to get this car, and it came out and I drove it at Adelaide. So it was a brand-new car with test mileage. So then we went to Perth and I was on pole and led the race. Could have, would have, should have, could have won the race. Mm. So in my second touring car race, I could have won the race, but I didn't. And then Robbie wanted the car because it was better, obviously.
I'll have what he's having.
Or he saw it as being better. So he took the car and then I had the left-hand drive car, which was the older car, which was built in 84. And then at Lakeside, I can't remember what happened to his car, but anyway, yeah, I said to Sheppo, Robbie can have my car. You know, I mean, I just thought it was the right thing to do. Mm. So.
Worked out all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Australian Muscle Car Magazine is one of the most respected voices in motoring media. There's been over 140 issues and thousands of stories published in the last 22 years, from the amazing muscle car machines of the past to the present and the stars that steered and built them. AMC has something for everyone. Delve into the heritage of homegrown high performance now at musclecarmag.com.au.
So he wins the championship.
Yeah.
But then the Sandown 500 comes.
Yeah.
And mid-weekend, it's a bit different now because the championship counts for all the races right through
Sandown, Bathurst wasn't in
back in those days, wasn't. But it'd be like the champion of supercars on the eve of leading the championship on the eve of the first endurance race, if we had more than one, which we should, but that's another story.
Yes.
having a massive spat with his team and walking out.
Yes.
But what happened?
Well, it's not walking out.
It all blew apart.
Yeah. He didn't walk out. He was sacked.
Mm.
There's no.
Well, he had to walk out after he was sacked. So.
Yes, there's no question.
So what happened that weekend from.
Well, it was a build up because John Shepherd, as the Volvo dealer team, had decided to build a car locally. So they sourced, a body shell. It was actually a road car. And they got all the bits in a great big wooden crate from Sweden. It was a proper factory thing, but he built it out of a local car. And as all race cars seem to be, it was late. And so practice on Friday at Sandown for the Sandown 500 didn't – the car wasn't there. So not Robbie's finished. Wasn't there.
But yours was.
No, mine wasn't either. Oh, right. They were not there. The car was – no.
This is zero there's
no
two,
car there. No. So we're out at Sandown all waiting. Like I've said before, Robbie had quite a short fuse and he's, really getting agitated about all this. And it was because of my car, which was allocated to me, being late
Everything was late.
Everything was late, yeah. So, the cars were based at Calder. They had a factory out there. And eventually it turned up about 4:30 or something on Friday afternoon and they unloaded it and put it in the garages, which is still the same garages as now. Mm. And Robbie, this is my memory, so maybe if someone knows a better story than this, they can write in or something, but this is how I remember it. Robbie marches into the garage and kicks the door of my car, my brand-new car.
Brand spanker.
Yeah, which they've worked like 3 days straight with no sleep to get it ready to take to the track. So he puts this big dent in the door because the cars were quite special cars. You know, they were – the doors were light gauge and the panels were – special panels and, you know, they were...
There was plenty going on in the Group A.
Homologation like specials they were. Yep. And you know, they had plastic headlights when no one had plastic headlights. Mm. So it was they were quite trick cars. Anyway, the long and the short of all this was Shippo, and I'm not sure how it all played out in words, but...
I'm guessing it was fruity.
I imagine so. Shippo sacked him.
At the event on the spot.
At the event on the spot, yeah. And then they had a press conference, which I didn't go to. Like, I was a junior, you know, lucky to be there and happy to be there. And so that's what happened. And then after that, I think he went to Bathurst with Mark Pitch, had a Sierra XR4i or something, yeah. So Robbie was around for a bit longer after that. But, yeah, that was unfortunately and I think that – contributed to Volvo thinking very conservative company and Volvo pulling the pin on the whole thing, saying, you know, bad publicity sort of thing. Mm. So, and I've never actually spoken to Shippo about it, to be honest. I just, this is observations from the sideline.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very controversial. You would have a copy in your vault here.
There'd be a magazine
of Motorsport News or Auto Action or something that has got that story because it was big news.
Oh, when the reigning current champion is sacked on the weekend of the first major race, it's big news. Well, what were those cars like to drive, things? Like, I know you've talked about the Skyline over the years and gone, oh, not so good. Everyone would make jokes about the Volvo.
Oh, yeah.
But as a car to drive, what was its strengths? What was its weaknesses? What sticks in your mind?
Very good braking. The Volvo I thought was good, but you got to understand I didn't know anything about anything.
What did you have it to compare
it to? I had nothing to compare it with. You know, the early stages, and I think I've probably said this many times, the first year I drove with Robbie at Bathurst, I was, you know, mortified by the thing because it bounced and leapt and shimmied and leaned over and, you know, all that stuff. And Alan Grice helped me out. You know, he drove me around and said, this is what it's going to do here. He'd never driven a Volvo, but he's very proficient in touring cars. And, you know, so the next day I was fine with it. But, you know, I just – driving a single seater is very, you know, I think people should drive single seaters personally because I think it makes them better drivers.
But they're perfect built.
Yeah, but they are very, you know, if they understeer, they don't understeer badly, and if they oversteer, they don't oversteer badly, and they certainly don't lean.
No.
Or anything like
an 80s touring car.
No, not like an 80s Group A Volvo. So anyway, I'll always be very grateful for Gricey for that because – you know, it put my mind at ease and then I just got in it and drove it. So it was a good car. Like the Calder round of that first season, 86, I was leading that too. And I could have won that, could have, would have, should have. So I could have won the first two rounds that I'd ever been in.
Mm.
But, or the third, first two out of three.
Two out of three ain't bad.
It ran out of petrol in the last lap.
Oh, they'll do it.
So it started to sputter and, I finished, but I can't remember where, I think third or fourth. But, yeah, so it was really good to drive, really good. But it would have only been good the next year because the next year by Bathurst, the RS500 Sierras had turned up and they reinvented Group A to
move the market
way beyond. But early 87, they would have been quite competitive with the normal Sierras, with the Nissans still because they were still competitive and, you know. So they were actually a good car, but it was a proper factory-developed car. Volvo had a motorsport department and it was a really clever car.
Because didn't you drive that car in more recent times, in, I don't know, a couple of years back, that's been restored in the Volvo dealer team livery? And
that was the later car. That was the new one, the controversial one.
The one that Robbie kicked.
Robbie kicked, yeah. So Mark Pitch ended up buying it, found it somewhere in Sweden, I think. It went back to Sweden, both the three cars.
Yeah, everything was
Went back to Sweden because it
sounds a bit like Gary Rogers, what he had later on.
I guess so, yeah. I suspect that the factory, and I've never asked, so you're triggering things in my poor brain here, but I think they probably owned it all, and so it all just went back, because I know Neville Crichton tried to buy it and tried to get Volvo interested in keeping it, keeping involvement, and they didn't and wouldn't, and it all just packed up and went back to Sweden. So Mark Pitch bought it back, the last car. He also bought the other one. He found the other one. So he's still got that too. And he restored it all, and he brought it over to Phillip Island. It gave trouble. I raced it. It went okay, but it was troublesome because it was new. Mm. And nowadays on turbo cars in Group A, you're allowed to put a modern-day engine management on them.
Which generally fixes lots of the ills. That
And it did. It had a Motec on it, but it wasn't right, so we had a bit of drama, you know, over the weekend, but it went okay. Went okay. I remember having quite a good battle with various people in the races. It's certainly no Sierra, that's for sure. No. But early on, like Friday practice, I'm coming over Lukey Heights and down into the MG, is, I don't know what they call it now, but it's maybe it's Maguire's Corner.
I still call it that. You call it what you like, really.
Yeah, okay. It kept locking the rear brakes. Locking the rear brakes, locking the rear brakes. And in the end, I'm trying to go faster, obviously, and I've spun under brakes with the rear brakes locked. I've gone back to Mark and I said, Mark, you know Bathurst in 1986? This car locked the rear brakes constantly.
Still doing it.
Constantly.
This is what?
No one could fix it.
30 years on.
30 years later, it's still got the same bloody problem. Can you get someone to fix it, please? So little Randall Edgell, who was back in the day, was there with Mark. And so he's climbed under the dash, all the pedal boxes up under the dash, the master cylinders are all, and he's pulled all this stuff out, and it had the wrong, you know, the master cylinders back to front.
Don't tell me that it was like that the whole time
ever. Yes. So 30 years later, the problem's solved, and it was a beauty after that, because part of its strength, you know, not this particular car but the other right-hand drive car that I'd raced quite a bit, was it was really good under braking. You know, it would transfer its weight nice, and, you know, it was good. So anyway, I had a good weekend, and then later I went over to New Zealand, raced it at Hampton Downs.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten how they were – very inclined to stand up on two wheels when you had really good tyres on them. I'd forgotten all that.
Too much grip
and too narrow on the track and too high and, you know, whatever.
There's lots of laws. Block of flats and all the stuff.
Yeah, block of flats. That's what Dick used to call them.
Yeah.
Yeah, this block of flats in front of me. Anyway, yeah. A block of flats now is like 30 stories high, isn't it? But back then it wasn't. I've had a practice at Hampton Downs, great little track, one of Tony Quinn's tracks, and it was fun. You know, it was a Group A and Super Touring.
Mm.
Now, those Super Touring cars were trick cars, and they were faster. But Jimmy Richards was driving the 635 with a four-valve engine.
The Group C car.
Group C car. And him and I had a good battle. And, I mean, I'm a huge admirer of him, you know, so it was fun. And so I've put these new tyres on. Mark was, you know, reticent to spend the money, but anyway, I insisted we had new tyres for Collie. And so I've warmed the tyres up like you do as you learn as you go along, you know, and I've fired off onto my first lap, and I've got to this about halfway around the lap, and there's a corner called Double Bastard. That's Tony Quinn called it that. So I don't know whether it's officially called Double Bastard or what.
If he owns a track and he calls it that.
Because of whatever he likes, yes. Anyway, I got to the first part of the Double Bastard and I was fired in there, and it stood up on two wheels, and I honestly thought it was going to tip over on its roof.
Are we talking 45 degrees?
Yeah, way up. So I've had to steer the thing down. You know, so it's a left-hander. I've steered it down to the right. It's dropped back down, so I thought, oh, right, I better reevaluate all this, and I've gone around again, started a lap again. But, yeah, so it was, I think probably the tyres are better nowadays than they were then too, you know. But I had some great fun, really good fun.
It's a short period, but it's well remembered by so many people, because it was the bit that got you started in the touring car stuff, which was what the general public were – were viewing more so than the sports cars.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at any of the old footage, television footage, and you see the crowds, they were big crowds. Mm. You know, I don't know whether they even counted crowds then, but they were big.
I'm sure they knew because it meant how many tickets they'd sold.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, so it was a you know, and because it had lots of variety. You know, it had that first year Dick had his Mustang. There were BMWs for Africa. You know, like
lots of people. Yeah, BMW. Alphas, Commodores.
Toyotas, yeah,
lots Mitsubishis.
Of Mitsubishis. Yes, lots of stuff. So yeah. Lots of brands, and it was. Everyone had an interest in it, and, you know, on television that was really the only motor racing that was on television. So.
And once Channel 7 got behind it and grabbed the touring car rights, they had Bathurst, and it was that terrific. Sort of naturally stitched it all together.
I remember, you know, the Lakeside race where I gave up my car. I think Wilco came climbing out of the lake, I think. You know, they always had a story.
Yes, yes. Those opening hostings.
Yeah, they were so funny.
The casino on the Gold Coast.
Yes, and the
I think Wilco was a jockey at Sandown one day.
I think he came out of the desert at Wanneroo it was really
– hot air balloons at Amaroo. And
it was all new stuff, you know, anyway. Groundbreaking things.
It was. You mentioned earlier, I don't think we covered off this much in our – chat a few years back. It's a while ago, so if we've repeated anything, we're very sorry and didn't mean to.
Yeah.
The Viscander. Tell me about the origins of the Viscander. It's one of the coolest sports cars of the 80s in Australia.
It was the coolest.
What got you connected into that?
Got me connected was K&A Engineering, Dale Connacky and Harry Ost. That's who K&A were. They built this car for Bernie Van Elsen, who was a sports car racer. He had a Bolwell Nagari sports car that K&A had done a lot of work on. They were very clever, really
dead set. In South Australia.
Dead set clever, yeah. They were part of, in that era, you know, it was a lot of South Australian motor racing going on.
Because Gary Cooper
was South Australia.
It was a pretty decent sized hub.
Yeah, it was, yeah. I'm not sure how I got connected. I'd asked them about I don't know how I got connected.
Hang on, I've got a theory. Sorry. Let's see if this reminds it. Did you go to – I think this was already after. They helped you with something with the Volvos, but I think you were already in the Viscander by that stage, which is why you knew to go and have a talk.
In 86, we went – when the car came from Sweden and I went to Adelaide Raceway, it didn't have a front anti-roll bar on it for some reason. Whether they didn't
send it, or attach whatever. It,
I don't
have
know.
One
I don't know. But anyway, it obviously had needed one. And I asked Sheppo, could I get K&A to – so I rang them and they came out and measured it up and made one for it. So then I got on pole of the front row, which wasn't pole, but it was the front row.
Because in those days it was 3-2-3.
Yeah, 3-2-3. I don't tell people that. I just say I was on the front row and everybody thinks I was second, but I was actually third. So I knew them, but I knew Dale quite well because he used to work at Elfin.
Mm.
So I don't quite know. But anyway, Bernie, they built this car.
And it was cool.
And it was really a terrific car. And they asked me to test it to help sort it out. And Bernie went along with it, and I think they probably thought that Bernie wouldn't be up to it in terms of driving. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But anyway, I was just happy to drive it.
Mm.
First time we drove it, it broke the studs. It was a three-piece wheel, like a BBS. It wasn't a BBS. It was a Simmons, I think. And it wasn't up to the downforce. And the bodywork and tunnels and whatnot had been devised by the Murphy brothers, who were very well-credentialed motorsport people, been to America, been in
IndyCars and
Can-Am with VDS and whatever. So, you know, the car had a lot of downforce and it broke the studs. So I've gone off the track in turn one at AIR and hit the bank like some ferocious speed and got half trapped in the thing. And so that put the debut off for another 6 or 8 months while they fixed it, bent all the monocoque in the front and whatnot. And then they decided I was going to drive it. I think they just told Bernie, you know, I mean, Bernie was paying the bills and they were making the car.
You pay, he drives, we'll win.
Yeah, and, you know, it was a great, terrific car. It was obviously better than everything else around at the time.
It stepped the level.
Yeah, it did, yeah. Right. Yeah, probably caused the demise of sports car racing for 10 years after that. But
and what engine?
It had a Chevy.
So it
had,
like first, a 5.6?
No, originally had a 5-litre, iron-headed thing, you know, old-fashioned Chevy. And then eventually they put a, you know, a stroker kit in, so it ended up being a 350, a 6-litre. But no. Not mega power, but at the time it had 520 or 30 horsepower, something.
It's light. It's got good aero.
Oh, good aero, yeah. You know, I mean, it was just incredible to drive in the wet. I mean, in the wet, the rooster tails used to come out of the back of the car and go straight up in the air like 90 degrees. I don't know what that means in aerodynamic terms. But
it goes up quick.
Yeah, it was like it was just unbelievable to drive in the wet. It was so fast.
And you won the national championship in it.
Yeah, I won everything.
You pretty much were the dominant.
Yeah, I was.
If you didn't win it, we would have probably been worried because it was
– it was a great time. I mean, and they were terrific blokes. Bernie's a great bloke, still a great bloke. Dale and Harry, great fellas, you know. They were serious but fun. And, you know, he would give me – and I think we've probably done this before, but he would let me – he used to call me the driver – the driver is
capitalized.
The driver is allowed to have one gear ratio change for the weekend. He wouldn't do it any other time. Like he would do.
You pick when you want it, and don't stuff it up.
If I'd say, because I'd come out of open wheelers, so you're constantly fiddling with gear ratios. If I'd say, look, I need a taller second and a lower third or a taller top or whatever, he would say, okay, you sure about this? I'd sit there and study the gear charts for like an hour and make sure I was right, because he wouldn't do it again.
That was it.
It was it. He would do it once. So it was just good fun. And you know, later the car was parked in the corner. So from 19 – Dick and I drove it at Sandown in 88 when they
had – World Endurance.
World Endurance, yep. Yeah. And then it was parked in the corner until 2000.
Mm.
So it sat – under a dust cover for 12 years.
Because we should cover it quickly. So for those who don't know, and I keep saying these because I forget that we have younger listeners who might not have been around.
Yeah.
So Sandown held a round of the World Sports Prototype Championship, as it was, in 84. That's where they lengthened the track on the infield. Mm-hmm. They lost a lot of money, the Light Car Club at the time.
I think it sent them broke, didn't it?
It just about did. Yeah. And then in 88, they came back and did it again.
Yes.
Which went pretty much the same way.
Yes.
And there were the Silk Cut Jags, the Sauber Mercedes, like they were mega
trick
sports cars of the period that ran at Le Mans. Jags had won at Le Mans that year. But the Viscander, which, you know, wasn't part of kind of that, but it fit into a class for the race. And you and Dick ran the car. I think you finished like seventh or eighth or something.
Oh, we got disqualified.
But there was, you got booted because at the time there was like a really rigid fuel
consumption.
Ruling.
Yeah.
You could only use a certain amount of literage for the race, which you guys
couldn't do. We couldn't make it.
No matter what.
So we were basically going to run out of fuel. So the boys took the decision to tip a bit more in, and that was, you know, that was.
Finish the race, but get booted.
Forbidden. And so, yeah, so we finished the race. And it was, yeah, it was, the cars were awesome cars, but the rules were crazy, you know, like it was all about. Lift and coast, which everybody talks about now, you know, to save fuel and all that sort of stuff. Yes. You know, it's not racing.
No,
racing really.
Not when you've got to do it all the time to make it through the race.
Yeah, like say you'd get to say you'd the car would brake at the 150 mark. Well, you'd lift off at 200 and coast in and then put the brakes on. You know, it was like driving to the supermarket. Yeah. It was stupid. When you see historic Group C now in Europe, they don't have fuel consumption, so they're really on it. Mm. You know, so it's how it should have been back then. But the rules, you know, rules aren't always correct.
No.
Funnily enough.
Sound like you've been in racing for a while.
Yeah, 50 years.
So the Viscander sat around for a while and then it came back and ran in historics and it, like Paul Stubber ended up, I think it went to Le Mans, didn't it?
It's a funny story because in 2000, Bernie rang me and I mean, I remember where I was when he rang me. He said, would you drive the he called it the candy car would you drive it at Phillip Island Historics? Because, I mean, he's quite a smart bloke, and he thought if we drove it and it looked good, he'd sell it, which is what happened, you know. So I'd go, yeah, I'd love to drive it as long as K&A prep it.
It's been sitting around for the best part of 12
Yeah, exactly. And they are very, you know, they were, and I'm sure they still are, very safety-minded, you know. They didn't want to kill anybody, so to speak. And so they prepped it, and I turned up and had the same seat that I had in 1986. Same everything. Same everything.
Gold.
And we couldn't get tyres. Well, they put Goodyear radials on it. Back in the day, it had so much downforce at the back that Russell Stuckey instigated this. Dunlop in Japan made special tyres for it.
Because it pushed down so far because of the downforce?
Because it needed mega strong sidewalls.
Because it would otherwise crush down.
It'd squash it down and
blow them out.
Well, it wouldn't blow them out, but it just was
put too much
wobbled around too much.
Yep.
I've never been into cars that wobble too much, to be honest.
No, don't like wobbling.
I don't like wobbling. Anyway, I drove it on these Goodyears on the Friday at Phillip Island Historics in 2000. So we're talking 22 years ago. And it was bloody petrifying. Like it was white knuckle stuff.
Well, Phillip Island wasn't a racetrack in the time that car raced.
No, it wasn't. It had never gone that fast because at Sandown it wouldn't go as fast as it does at Phillip Island, as in top speed. And so at the end of the front straight at Porpoise, which if you watch the Formula One
Formula One speed,
It porpoised like crazy. Your eyes would go out of focus and the rear was so unstable you felt like it was just about to jump over the fence.
And you agreed to do this.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, what have I done? And then I went to see Russell, who has been at every Phillip Island historic meeting I've ever been to and most other race meetings I've ever been to. And I said, you know those tyres that you guys used to make for the Vescander? And he goes, yeah. I said, you wouldn't happen to have any, would you?
No.
So this is from 86 he got them done and 2000, so 14 years later, and he's got some.
What?
He rang his shop in Brunswick or wherever it is. Sydney Road, and he said, yeah, no, we've got some. So I'll get them down tonight. So he got them down that night, and the tyres were – so the car was beautiful the next day, like absolutely fixed it.
Paid to hang on to those,
absolutely,
didn't it?
Absolutely. Cool. So it was really good, funny story. So we had a great time. And then Bernie sold it. He sold it to John Briggs, funnily enough.
Right. Yeah,
who we touched on last podcast.
We did touch on that last podcast.
100 and whatever podcasts ago.
We could go back to F1. If you haven't heard JB's chat about his John Briggs Motorsport era, go back to F1 at the end of this ep and you'll hear.
Yeah, so then Briggsy raced it a few times. He got Kenny Mack to build a
Kenny McNamara, who runs KRE, that does the
does all
triple eight engines.
Triple eight engines is going to do the new Gen 3 Chevy engines. He built a super engine for it, like a 700 horsepower engine, where it didn't have anything like that when I drove it. And he raced it for quite a while. He went quite well in it, I think. And then Paul Stubber bought it. And Paul wanted to take it to Europe because Group C racing over there, historic, is quite big.
Cars eligible.
It was built to Group C regs. But over there, they allow you to run modern wheels and tyres and modern brakes and things. So he ended up with 18-inch wheels on it, Michelin-style Group C tyres that they make for modern-day Group C racing. And he took it over and he went quite well. Like Paul Stubber's a good driver, he went quite well. And now it's back in Perth, I believe, but it can't race here because Motorsport Australia don't recognise it in its new form because
it didn't race like that.
Didn't race like that.
So if you want to race it, you'd have to
put 16-inch wheels and so on. Right. And it's got how they would view the engine management and the fuel injection, I'm not sure. But anyway, I know that, he wanted to race it at Phillip Island or whatever several times and it wasn't allowed.
Right.
Whether that's the case nowadays or not, I'm not sure. But, it was a great car.
The good news is it's around. It exists.
It still exists.
Cool.
There was another one made that I think might have raced once or something, but it's no one's, you know, it's lost, disappeared in someone's
might
shed.
Need some sleuthing, JB.
It could need some sleuthing because and there was another one much later that they built, three quarters built, as a road car. With a, I think an LS engine or something, but I don't think it was ever finished. So yeah, it might need a bit of sleuthing.
Bit of sleuthing, it's a thing.
Because the second one that was raceable would still be raceable, I suspect.
If it hasn't been modified.
Yeah, if it hasn't been
raced. Yeah,
yeah, if it hasn't been chopped up or you know, a lot of those cars were turned into sports sedans and things too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So and it'd be good to see. I mean, it was a great car. Like those guys were smart. You know, they were clever. It was a really, really good car. Very stiff in the chassis. It was still aluminium. It wasn't no carbon or anything.
No, no.
But a very, they were clever blokes.
Yeah. Mm. And that's part one of my chat with John Bauer. I hope you enjoyed listening to some of those great stories from over his amazing career. And the best part is we're not done. Part two is to come next week. To give you a little bit of a taste, we talk about his time at Brad Jones Racing. We talk about what it was like finishing second to Lap of the Gods. Gee, he loves that topic. JB's massive crash at Pukekohe in 2006. A change he'd like to make to the Touring Car Masters regulations. A Bathurst drive that he turned down, which, quite frankly, put me on the floor. I could not believe that I'd not heard this story. And he'll tackle your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions as well. I really need to tell you that you really need to jump online and visit a website for me. It's bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. It's got our amazing range of books and magazines, programs. We've got some pre-owned material on our online store, which is just amazing. Magazines, programs, books. It is simply sensational. You'll find some really great gems there, plus all the latest stuff, model cars, prints, DVDs, a bit of everything for the motorsport fan. Sign up to our newsletter through the v8sleuth.com.au website as well. Follow us on the socials, you know the drill, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Send us a message. We love to hear from all of our V8 Sleuth followers. In the meantime, though, that's us done for this podcast. Part two of John Bauer is coming next week. Don't forget, Repco Supercars Weekly every Thursday and the Castrol Motorsport News Podcast every Tuesday. I'll chat to you soon.
Every lap in under a minute. Every move made to matter. Every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.